Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies titled Zionism and Antisemitism, Ideologies or Emotions. Our speaker is Derek Penslar, Harvard University Visiting Professor of History. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Wiesel Center Professor of Religion, Michael Zank.
I now want to introduce our main speaker, Professor Derek Penslar, who is the Samuel Zaks Professor of Jewish History at the University of Toronto, currently visiting Professor of History at Harvard University. His research specialties are the history of modern European Jewry, Zionism, and the State of Israel. His books include Zionism and Technocracy, The Engineering of Jewish Settlement in Palestine, 1870 to 1918, which appeared in 1991 in English and in Hebrew in 2001. In Search of Jewish Community, Jewish Identities in Germany and Austria, 1918 to 1933. This is a volume co-edited with Michael Brenner. He wrote a book in 2001 on Shylock's Children, Economics and Jewish Identity in Modern Europe. In 2004, he co-edited a volume on Orientalism and the Jews. 2005, a book on contemporary antisemitism in Canada and the world. And, of course, today he will consider further the issue of antisemitism, but from a different angle. He's written on Israel in history, the Jewish state in comparative perspective. So he's not just a historian, he's also a comparative political scientist. And on the origins of the State of Israel, 1882 to 1948, a documentary history with Eran Kaplan, published in 2011. Finally, 2013, a book on Jews and the military. Professor Penslar.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael, for the invitation. Thank you for the very kind introduction. Thanks to so many of you for coming. And yeah, this is a kind of traditional academic paper, which means I am reading a paper, but I will hopefully not be too monotonous. Okay, so we're accustomed to defining nationalism as an ideology or a means of identification, but I would propose instead that we conceive of nationalism as a form of emotional self-medication. Its narrative of a sempiternal community offers, if not a cure, then at least a tonic that allays the fear of death. The notion that one does belong to a certain nation and that others do not enables and provides shelter from social marginalization or exclusion, which scholars have tellingly termed social death. The nationalist idea provides justification and rationalization for feelings such as resentment, hatred, anger, loneliness, anxiety, guilt, and shame. Last but not least, nationalism is the continuation of Eros by other means. It both co-opts and supplants the romantic love that joins humans into long-lasting pair bonds and makes possible the continuation of the species. These emotionally therapeutic qualities of nationalism are all readily apparent in Zionism. Like other forms of nationalism, Zionism employs ideology to sustain an emotional community, united by negative emotions as well as positive ones, such as love and pride or hope. Zionism's emotional register has been deeply influenced by the presence, absence, and nature of ambient antisemitism. Like other forms of racism, antisemitism provides an ideological veneer for emotions such as fear, resentment, despair, and shame. This afternoon, I wish to explore the interaction between two powerful affective forces, Zionism and antisemitism, using as a case study Zionist diplomacy from the mid-1890s into the early 1920s, that is, from the outset of Theodor Herzl's brief but meteoric Zionist career to the wartime Zionist leadership of Chaim Weizmann, the issuing of the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and both Zionist and anti-Semitic reactions to that transformational event. Possessed of radically different personalities and operating under radically different geopolitical circumstances, Theodor Herzl elevated anti-Semitism into an ideology, while Chaim Weizmann engaged with it as an emotion. Conversely, At first, anti-Semites saw in Zionism a source of emotional relief. But in the aftermath of World War I and the issuing of the Balfour Declaration, they incorporated Zionism into an increasingly monolithic and ominous ideology. Now, I want to start by defining terms, ideology and emotion. By ideology, I mean a coherent and sustained interpretation of experience in terms of fundamental beliefs and values. Ideologies function via both deductive and inductive logic, first principles, and empirical observation. They lay claim to rationality, although in fact they might not be rational. This definition goes beyond Marxist and neo-Marxist conceptions of ideology as the belief system of dominant classes and reflective of their economic interests. It encompasses religion broadly understood, and all of the systematic political systems of late modernity, liberalism, communism, fascism. By this rubric, both anti-Semitism and Zionism can be classified as ideologies, but an individual who defines herself or who is defined by others as anti-Semitic or Zionist does not necessarily structure her interpretive universe around either of these isms. That is, one can have an aversion to Jews without perceiving history as an eternal struggle between Jews and Gentiles. Similarly, one can feel an identification with or attachment to the State of Israel without identifying oneself exclusively in terms of Zionism. Now, the term Zionist has often been employed as a pejorative, first in the Stalinist Soviet Union, then throughout the Arab world, and most recently in leftist academic circles throughout the Western world. Conversely, the word anti-Semite has at times been brandished with pride, particularly in German-speaking Europe from the 1880s through 1945. That said, for the past century, the word anti-Semite has usually been associated with opprobrium, to the point that in our own era, it is not uncommon for people who hate Jews to deny that they're anti-Semites. For this reason, it is far more likely that someone who explicitly calls himself an anti-Semite espouses a sustained and wide-ranging anti-Semitic ideology than that someone who calls himself a Zionist would in fact structure his entire life around a commitment to the well-being of the State of Israel, however you define that concept. Ideology can have unconscious sources. It is therefore not sealed off from feeling. Going back to the days of Freud and William James, people have debated about the seat of emotion in the psyche or in the body, whether it is culturally constructed or common to all humans, and whether it is a hallmark of the primitive, which in the Western world was subdued via the civilizing process, or whether it is always present but performed in changing ways. Talking about how emotion is performed, however, doesn't get us any closer to defining what emotion is. So, we could call emotional irrational or non-rational cognition and volition. We often justify our emotions, however, in terms of reality and logic. Besides, people can base logical argumentation on preposterous assumptions or draw conclusions from biased observations. An emotion, then, is no more or less rational than a concept or an idea. Moreover, both emotion and ideology are expressed through language. The difference between the two is that emotion begins with an inchoate feeling, which is after the fact, although perhaps milliseconds thereafter, nanoseconds thereafter, expressed via language, whereas ideology is encased in language, which elicits emotional reactions. That is, we only know what we are feeling once we have put it into words, even if the words are only in our head. But the words that we use and the actions we take as a result of those words vary greatly across time and space. So I suggest we abandon the whole notion of emotion and rationality or irrationality, and following the political scientist Roger Peterson, define emotion as psychological mechanisms that regulate the intensity and salience of desire. Now, that's a very strange-sounding definition, but I think it really works. Regulating the intensity and saliency of desire. You love something, you hate something, you resent something. And actually, you think it through, it's very helpful. Except I would embellish the definition somewhat. By classifying negative emotions, such as fear or resentment or hatred rage, jealousy, as expressions of disequilibrium and unfulfilled desire. Whereas positive emotions, such as pride, contentment, magnanimity, are expressions of real or anticipated equilibrium, of having achieved or imminent expectation of achieving certain wants and needs. And then the interesting question is, what do we do with love? Is it a positive emotion or a negative emotion? Because it can indicate both fulfilled and unfulfilled, fulfillable and unfulfillable desires, which is perhaps why we are told in the Song of Songs that love is as strong as death. On this view, anti-Semitism is a verbalization of disequilibrium and unfulfilled desire. Zionism combines aspects of disequilibrium and equilibrium, of longing and fulfillment. Both anti-Semitism and Zionism are equally affective in origin, but they draw on different emotional palettes. And that's sort of, as I'm trying to work through the, in German you would say, the Fragestellung, to try to sort of think through where this project is going to start. So that's sort of where I'm starting from. Now let me do a concrete sort of application. The relationship between affect and ideology, concretely explained in terms of a couple of real live human beings. Let's start with Theodor Herzl's Zionism and the extent to which his Zionism was a product of anti-Semitism. Now, that second question's a bit easier to answer. But my argument might appear counterintuitive because I actually don't believe that anti-Semitism does anything more than partially account for Herzl's turn to Zionism. Now, the connection between anti-Semitism and why Herzl, or anyone of his era, would embrace Zionism appears obvious. As a university student, and later as a state attorney, so those of you who are thinking of law school, you never know what you might become, Herzl endured disturbing anti-Semitic incidents. And at the age of 22, he was badly shaken by Eugen Döring's anti-Semitic screed, Die Judenfrage als Frage des Rassencharakters und seiner Schädlichkeit für Existenz und Kultur des Volkes. The Jewish question as a question of racial character and its destructive effects upon the existence and civilization of peoples. Herzl did not, however, react in any sustained way to anti-Semitic slights until 1893. And rather than adopt Jewish nationalism, he fantasized about both a mass Jewish conversion to Catholicism and Jewish participation in a great socialist revolution that would put an end to social injustice and thus anti-Semitism. Herzl's growing Jewish self-awareness and self-pride are quite clear in his most famous play, The New Ghetto, of 1894, written shortly before Alfred Dreyfus's first trial for espionage, which Herzl covered as the Paris correspondent of the most famous or distinguished newspaper in Central Europe, Die Neue Freie Presse, the New Free Press. Simultaneous events in Vienna, where the anti-Semitic city councilor and Christian socialist Karl Lueger was elected mayor, although not seated till 1897, sent Herzl into a delirious state, and he began to scribble in a diary a mixture of incoherent and brilliant thoughts that became the core of his 1896 pamphlet, The Jewish State. So that's on the one hand, anti-Semitism, Zionism. On the other hand, Herzl was hardly alone among Central European Jews in being exposed to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism's everywhere. Most Jews in Central Europe don't become Zionists. So anti-Semitism is a necessary but insufficient condition for Herzl's turn to Zionism. The other essential component was his own chronic state of psychological distress. Throughout his life, Herzl battled depression, and he freely acknowledged that only success, be it theatrical, journalistic, or political, could pull him out of his funks. Although Herzl did establish some friendships, in general, it was extremely difficult for him to establish close relations, especially romantic or erotic ones with others. Herzl's ability to form lasting and loving relationships was stunted by the death during his late teens of his sister Pauline and a young woman named Madeleine Herz, the daughter of family friends on whom he had an unrequited schoolboy crush. Herzl never had a sustained and intimate erotic relationship with an individual of either gender. Many of Herzl's feuilletons are coated in a sugary sentimentality that does not conceal their bitter emotional core. In one of Herzl's best short tales, Sarah Holtzman, it's from 1896. He wrote almost exactly the same time he wrote The Jewish State. The irretrievable girl-woman from Herzl's erotic past takes the form of a beautiful but sad-faced lass whose brassy and bejeweled mother is having an affair. The story is told by a friend of the family, a tortured and struggling artist, Herzl, whose love for the girl is avuncular yet also romantic. In Sarah Holtzman, Herzl has clearly placed himself in the position of the narrator, as he does 6 years later in his story, Die Brille, The Reading Glasses, about a man approaching middle age with weakening vision. A rather blurred image of a young woman in a hotel salon reminds him of, yes, yet again, a 14-year-old girl whom he had loved in his youth. As a political thinker and leader, Herzl may have had a powerful vision of the Jewish future, but emotionally, Herzl remained fixated in the past. Now again, these writings in and of themselves don't tell us why Herzl became a Zionist. They tell us that he was messed up. But messed up people can do lots of different things. They testify to a blocked and suffering emotional self that cannot be accounted for solely by exogenous factors like anti-Semitism. Emotional pain does not constitute, again, a sufficient precondition for becoming a Zionist. Two other emotions, though, precluded alternatives. Pride kept him from favoring a mass conversion of Jews to Christianity. And fear of anarchy kept him at arm's length from socialism. Herzl actually was in a state in 1895 where fear kept him from embracing one solution, pride another. He was actually headed towards a total nervous breakdown. But the Zionist project gave him structure and it kept him in one piece until the frailties of his body overcame the weakness of his psyche and he died of myocardiopathy at the age of 44. Herzl's Zionism was linked to an overpowering sense of shame that haunted him from his youth. As a student, Herzl castigated himself for avoiding fighting a duel or for failing to keep his passion sufficiently under control. I've seen this in German Jewish memoirs and diaries. I'm sure it's not unique to German Jews when they excoriate themselves for their Sinnlichkeit, right, their sensuality. Herzl also expressed disgust with other Jews, whom he found ugly and vulgar. He writes about this rather explicitly in his letters. Scholars have routinely placed this feeling under the rubric of Jewish self-hatred, Selbsthass. This term does little to explain why certain fin de siècle Jews were so much more vulnerable than others to use a medical analogy, a cytokine storm of revulsion over alleged flaws in the Jewish character. Intriguingly, expressions of shame and its opposite, honor, rarely appear in Herzl's feuilletons, yet they are central in his Zionist writings, including the diaries and his novel of 1902, Ad Neuland. Perhaps it was only in writings intended explicitly for a Jewish audience that Herzl could openly confront these feelings, which were no less part of his psyche than the melancholy and the yearning that suffuse his feuilleton. Herzl's writings are filled with heroic men, manly men, possessed of noble sentiments, and what Herzl frequently referred to as icy calm. These figures were projections of his own self-fashioning as psychologically exoskeletal, with a surface as hard and brilliant as his prose. In his pamphlet, The Jewish State, Herzl presents himself, and it's remarkable, how many people here have read Herzl's The Jewish State? So a few of you have read it. It's a remarkable performance, and it has to be read on sort of three or four levels simultaneously. It is a performance of rationality, of a man who's embraced Zionism, not as a passion, but has discovered it as a fact of nature. Of course, we have no alternative. It's a cool and apparently detached diagnosis of and a cure for Judeophobia. Herzl claims that he approaches anti-Semitism, quote, without fear or hatred, sort of like Thucydides, sine ire et studio, without emotions indicative of disequilibrium or psychological turbulence. He sees in anti-Semitism elements of purported self-defense, that's quoting Herzl. Emancipated Jews are well-suited for commerce and the professions, and they compete with Gentiles. It's all very logical, Herzl writes. For Herzl, anti-Semitism, then, as he presents it, performs it, is not entirely irrational. And it will behoove anti-Semites, he writes in Der Judenstaat, to get rid of the Jews. For this reason, they will support his endeavor. And I'm quoting from Der Judenstaat. Honest anti-Semites whilst preserving their independence, will combine with our officials in controlling the transfer of our estates. Anti-Semites will even buy shares in the economic arm of the Zionist enterprise known as the Jewish Company. The Zionists will repay this kindness by giving, quote, every assistance to governments and parliaments in their efforts to direct the inner migration of Christian citizens, end quote, to formerly Jewish properties. The only emotion that Herzl expresses in these parts of Der Judenstaat is pride, manifest in a yearning for honor. Deeply concerned about the reputation of Europe's Jews, Herzl writes, and I'm quoting, every obligation in the old country must be scrupulously fulfilled before leaving. Every private claim originating in the abandoned countries will be heard more readily in the Jewish state than anywhere else. We shall not wait for reciprocity. We shall act purely for the sake of our own honor. And in one of the pamphlet's most famous passages, Herzl foresees the protection of the holy sites, quote, assigning to them an extraterritorial status, as is well known in the law of nations. We shall form a guard of honor. Note how often the word honor appears in Der Judenstaat, about these sanctuaries, answering for the fulfillment of this duty with our existence. The Jews will die for the Gentiles. Now, we have a straightforward presentation, but underneath it there is clearly urgency and sympathy. It's the combination of superficial sang-froid and underlying desperation that makes the pamphlet so rhetorically effective. And the emotional effect of the pamphlet may be gleaned from the reaction of Herzl's closest friend and ally in the Zionist movement, Max Nordau. Nordau's correspondence with Herzl, by the way, is a great way of throwing a lens on this whole question of emotion, because Nordau himself was a very passionate person with terrible handwriting, by the way. Awful handwriting. And he writes a clearly agitated letter to Herzl. I can't read you the whole thing now, but just a phrase. Highly heroic is this more than brave, indeed utterly fearless, Todeskühne, it's a great German word, recognition of the ultimate feeling which all Jews until now have borne in the deepest recesses of their soul. You must be able to empathize with me. Sie müssen es mir nachfühlen können, that I do this, that I react with such force. And in the years to come, Herzl would be very well aware of the emotional effect he had on his followers. Although somewhat wary of the adulation he received, he knew that the success of Zionism depended upon emotional energy, of which he was the center. His carefully cultivated appearance, his stage management of the Zionist congresses, these were all performative acts designed to attract the masses to the movement. He would cultivate coolness, even if he was boiling inside. And boil he did, with wounded pride when shunted aside by the German emperor or the Ottoman sultan, irritation and pique when confronted by obstreperous Russian Jews on any number of issues, and most notoriously disgust with Jewish assimilationists. In his notorious essay from 1897, Mauschum, Herzl employs an old German pejorative verb for the speaking of Judeo-German, inextricably linked with sharp dealing, cheating, and insincerity. Transforming the verb into a proper noun, Herzl writes of Mauschel, which is really akin to kike, it's an ugly word, as a Jew without honor, quote, no true Jew can be an anti-Zionist, only Mauschel is one. So we've seen then that Herzl's Zionism was rooted in emotional distress and need, but was expressed by a pseudo-technocratic language that connoted control over the passions. His persona combined passion and empathy on the one hand with discipline and strength on the other. The former was embodied in his dark and deep-set eyes, which appeared to witness the tragic fate of the Jewish people, and the latter in his full, dark beard, which gave him the look of an ancient Near Eastern monarch. Herzl elicited awe from and instilled pride into his supporters. And this affective circulation between the leader and the led is typical of charismatic authority. By elevating anti-Semitism into a rational ideology, Herzl hoped to defeat it by spiriting away the irritant that lay at that ideology's source. Now, Herzl did enjoy some success among anti-Semites, including the Hungarian politician cum journalist Ivan von Simonyi and the notorious French journalist Edouard Drumont, who responded enthusiastically to the first Zionist Congress in 1897. For more than a decade, Drumont championed Zionism, not only because it would get rid of the Jews, but because Zionists were, he believed, men of honor who wanted to construct their own land rather than leech off of others. By 1913, however, Drumont had soured on Zionism, as it had given up on the grand goal of getting the Jews out of Europe to Palestine. Drumont blamed this shift on Jewish plutocrats like Maurice de Hirsch, thus displaying complete ignorance of why the Zionist movement actually did change and place more of a focus on cultural matters, things that had very little to do with Baron Maurice de Hirsch. Since anti-Semitism was at its heart an emotional manifestation reflecting social protest, economic anxieties, and so forth, Herzl's attempts to elevate it into a rational discourse were doomed to fail. Herzl also encountered anti-Semitism in his diplomatic activity, particularly with the German and Russian governments. The Chancellor and Foreign Secretary of Germany were both cold to him, and Kaiser Wilhelm II was wont to refer to Jews as kikes, killers of Christ, and socialist revolutionaries. The Russian Interior Minister, Vyacheslav Pleva, was even more scornful. British officials were less overtly anti-Semitic, and Herzl was able to win sufficient trust from the colonial and foreign secretaries, Lord Lansdowne and Joseph Chamberlain respectively, to obtain an offer of territory in British East Africa. Herzl's diplomatic failures can't be attributed to anti-Semitism, rather to the simple fact that in international relations, actors get what they want through threatening and bargaining. And Herzl had nothing to threaten with, and actually very little to offer. His only bargaining chip was the claim of Jewish financial support to restructure the Ottoman debt. I don't think he really had access to that kind of money, but he said he did. It was not sufficiently enticing to win Ottoman imperial support for Zionism. Now there is, though, to get us back to the main theme of emotion, a third mechanism, aside from threatening and bargaining, by which international actors get what they want. And this is what my Oxford colleague Todd Hall calls emotional diplomacy. International actors signal intentions to each other through displays of official emotion, which may or may not be genuinely felt. It doesn't matter. It indicates and justifies major changes in foreign policy. The problem, though, is that Herzl never mastered emotional diplomacy. His appeals to the great powers were based in imperial self-interest and a developmental imperative. Only a decade after Herzl's death, the outbreak of World War I would change the geopolitical situation drastically, giving Chaim Weizmann not only something with which to bargain and threaten, but also a basis for emotional diplomacy with Palestine's future protector, the United Kingdom. So now we're done with Herzl, and we move on to Chaim Weizmann. Isaiah Berlin once remarked, "Like many visionaries, Herzl understood issues, but not human beings." Herzl, according to Berlin, did not understand the Eastern European Jewish masses, whereas Weizmann grasped their needs and articulated their views. Now, this is a rather romanticized and simplified image of both masses and leadership, and I don't want to add to the hagiographical literature on Weizmann that presents him as an earthy folk Jew whose soulful glance and sparkling wit encapsulated the spirit of the shtetl whence he came. Weizmann was no less than Herzl, a flawed man, vain and insecure, prone to hypochondriasis, an absent father, and unlike Herzl, a womanizer. Herzl did understand human beings, but only their externalities. As a journalist, he could describe the appearances and behaviors of people with great accuracy, but his attempts to penetrate their souls invariably fell flat. Herzl, though, possessed great empathy. Weizmann possessed great empathy. He was sensitive to both meanings of the term of empathy. He was easily hurt. He was sensitive. He was easily hurt, but also affectively bound up with the people he spoke with. Whereas Herzl seized on Zionism the way a drowning man seizes upon a life preserver, Weizmann evinced a confident and unreflective Zionism from childhood onward. He was a product of traditional Eastern European Jewish society. He had no qualms thinking about Jews as a collective, as a nation. It was merely a matter of which solution to the Jewish problem he would adopt. Two of his 12 siblings chose Bundism and communism with tragic results. As Shalom Ratzabi has written, When he was a student in Germany, Weizmann's naive love of Zion became more analytical and sophisticated, but he never became an original thinker or a polemicist. You think about this. When you read anthologies of Zionist writings, you read Herzl, Jabotinsky, Haram, we don't read Weizmann. And we don't read Weizmann for a reason, which is that he was a diplomat and he was not a thinker. Weizmann possessed the qualities, like Herzl, of two kinds of leadership: transformational and transactional. That's, transformational leadership is the charismatic ability to inspire the masses, but also transactional, meaning he could get things done. But Herzl was a tormented leader, whereas Weizmann was merely troubled. He communicated, Weizmann, as much via emotional signals as via direct references to raison d'état. In his conversations with British government figures, Weizmann consistently blended the historic wrongs committed against the Jews, which evoked pity and compassion, with their antiquity and their morality and their contributions to civilization, which elicited admiration and respect. So when you listen to Chaim Weizmann, you were exposed to a kind of an emotional storm, but a very pleasant emotional storm. You'd feel pity, sympathy, pride. Weizmann encountered complicated mixtures of anti-Semitism and philo-Semitism. At the outset of the war, Gerald Henry Fitzmaurice, a former British dragoman in Constantinople, proposed that the Allies offer Palestine to the Dunmes, that's the Jews who had converted to Islam at the time of Shabbatai Tzvi. In his view, they dominated the Young Turk government. Only as the war wore on did fantasies of Jewish power take the form of German Jews sabotaging their country's war effort, or American Jews pushing their country into war, or Russian Jews keeping their country in the fighting after the February Revolution. Arthur James Balfour met Weizmann in December of 1914. He heard Weizmann present a threnody of the Jews' legacy and suffering, and he was moved to tears. I'm quoting. And I'm now, this is actually Weizmann writing to Ahad Ha'am, so it could be that Weizmann is lying, but he writes, "Balfour took me by the hand and said I had illuminated for him the road followed by a great suffering nation." Now, 3 years later, after issuing the Balfour Declaration, Balfour told the Zionist political activist, writer, Lucien Wolff, that the Jews were exceedingly clever people who, in spite of their oppression, achieved a certain success which excited the jealousy and envy of the peoples among whom they lived. Well aware of his own interlocutor's potential for jealousy and envy, Weizmann exploited myths of Jewish power to discredit the American ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, Henry Morgenthau, accusing him of leading an international ring, this is, I'm quoting Weizmann, that Morgenthau was leading an international ring of Jewish financiers in Hamburg, Berlin, Vienna, Paris, and New York, plotting a German victory. So Weizmann knew how to read people's emotional state and how to appeal to it. So scholars have written at great length about the Balfour Declaration, its origins, its so forth. And the vast majority subordinate compassion to raison d'état. And rightly so, but they underestimate the significance of what Todd Hall, I mentioned him earlier, calls the diplomacy of sympathy. Now think about this. Weizmann offered cold, pragmatic reasons to the British. Jews will help the war effort in the United States. They'll help get the U.S. into the war. They'll keep Russia out of the war. However, he didn't hide the fact also that Zionists were pursuing the support of other powers. He did bargain and threaten. Fine. But then, why did he bother, and why did the British bother with this language of emotion, the sorrowful rendition of Jewish history, Balfour's tears, or even the denotation at the outset of the Balfour Declaration that His Majesty's government views with sympathy the establishment of a Jewish national home? So why bother with the emotional overlay? In emotional diplomacy, actors believe that their expressions of feeling will be welcomed by their interlocutor. In order to succeed, the signals have to appear sincere and indicate a willingness to make commitments or sacrifice. And the Balfour Declaration was a vast commitment, in return for which Weizmann and the Zionists were called upon to be of service. Dismissing the emotional component of the negotiations does not help us understand why that component existed in the first place. Why didn't the British and the Zionists simply speak in terms of naked interest, quid pro quo? The emotional signals and the tangible consequences of those signals are means of indicating sincerity. Sincerity fosters agreement between state or state-seeking actors, addressing the fundamental problem that lies at the base of all international relations, which is the inability to fathom another actor's intentions for good or ill. So I've spoken so far of the emotional signals that Weizmann and the British elite sent each other, but the emotional impact of the Balfour Declaration upon the Jewish public also deserves consideration. Throughout the Jewish world, the declaration was met with exclamations of joy, exclamations that need to be unpacked to understand their deeper meaning. The most commonly invoked emotion that you see in the Jewish press, 1918, 1919, is gratitude. Even the Conjoint Committee of the Anglo-Jewish Association and the Board of Jewish Deputies, which had opposed Weizmann during the war, noted the gratitude felt by Jews to the British. Weizmann himself called the declaration a Jewish Magna Carta. And that phrase was used actually quite a bit. Jewish Magna Carta. A number of people use it, and it's a striking invocation. When you think about it, Magna Carta was a concession of aristocratic privileges by an unpopular king to his rebellious barons. Its appearance in Zionist discourse connotes feelings of gratitude, but also pride, security, and self-confidence. It's a very interesting combination. And these newfound positive emotions, again, expressing states of fulfilled longing, the Balfour Declaration, and the immediate anticipation of fulfillment, a Jewish state. They were common. The American Jewish Congress at the end of 1918 urged that Jews now have, and I'm quoting, complete and unhampered independence in their own land. The American Jewish Committee called for a Jewish Commonwealth. Sorry, the American Jewish Congress's call for a Jewish Commonwealth, a state, was also echoed by the Pohelei Tzion, the workers of Zion, in their convention in Philadelphia. The call explicitly in late, well, not 1917, but in 1918, 1919, explicit calls for a Jewish state were legion. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, in February of 1919, one of the United States' most prominent rabbis, spoke about a trusteeship on behalf of the Jewish people, on behalf of the Jews over Palestine. He directly compared the Zionist cause to that of the redemption of Belgium and the recreation of Serbia, that is, the creation of states. Now, this support for Zionism, this sense of anticipation, of gratitude but also pride, was supported by the fact that the United States Congress explicitly endorsed the Balfour Declaration, first in 1918 and then again in 1922. Woodrow Wilson addressed Jewish notables in March of 1919, saying to Stephen S. Wise, Palestine will be yours. So what's the emotional underlay here to all of this? Setting aside of fear. The massive suffering they had endured during and especially after the war in the blood-soaked realm between the Baltic and Black Seas would be redeemed by a new Jewish national home. Now, as we know, more than 30 years separated the issuing of the Balfour Declaration from the establishment of Israel. The declaration did not staunch anti-Semitism. It intensified it. Unlike Herzl, whose diplomatic accomplishments were meager and attracted only a sidelong glance from anti-Semites, Weizmann won for the Jewish claim on Palestine the recognition of the world's mightiest empire. Anti-Semites were alarmed. The declaration elicited all emotions that lie at the core of modern anti-Semitism. Resentments over status inequity, hatred due to perceived wrongs, and despair engendered by a sense of powerlessness. In France, during the early interwar period, the far right was fiercely anti-British, and its activists saw in the Balfour Declaration proof of an Anglo-Zionist conspiracy to deprive France of its rightful imperial presence. For this reason, some rightists praise the Zionist demands for statehood as a form of resistance to British imperialism, keeping with French interests in the Middle East. But in Germany, which was crushed by the World War, seeing its territory reduced, its colonial empire stripped away, Zionism did not receive positive evaluations. As we learned from the important work of Francis Nicosia, the Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg wrote in the early 1920s, that the World War had been initiated by Jews to obtain a state in Palestine. And since they are incapable of any creative or administrative labor required for statecraft, what the Jews called a state would in fact be a power base for global nefarious economic operations. On this anti-Semitic view, there was no Anglo-Zionist conspiracy. No, the Jews enlisted the British as willing dupes. For a defeated people, the Germans, the anti-Semitic trope of Jewish omnipotence was a discursive correlate to a feeling of German powerlessness. Intriguingly, though, the most sustained anti-Semitic treatments of the Balfour Declaration did not come from defeated Germany. Ironically, they came from a victorious country, the United States. And its author is probably unknown to most people in this room. William J. Cameron, a round-faced, unprepossessing journalist from Hamilton, Ontario, would never have been known to history had he not left the Detroit Free News in 1918 to work for Henry Ford, whom he served between 1921 and 1927 as editor of the Dearborn Independent, and for whom he worked until 1946. Cameron was effectively Ford's spokesman and media handler. He was an adherent of the British Israelite movement, which avowed that the 10 lost tribes of Israel were the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxons, and that the Jews are the descendants from Judah, a mongrel Asiatic race. Cameron wrote all or most of the articles in the Dearborn Independent between March of 1920 and March of 1922 that were collected and published under the title The International Jew. In recorded reminiscences by the Ford Oral History Project in 1952, Cameron claimed to have been disgusted by his assignment to write anti-Semitic pieces, but in fact, he wrote the articles with great gusto. According to one scholar, Cameron's involvement with anti-Semitism was neither nominal nor reluctant. At least three times in the 1920s, Cameron met with the Nazi agent Kurtz Ludeke, who had been sent to the United States to mobilize support. There was no daylight between Cameron and Ford, with whom he lunched every day with Ford's son Edsel in the Ford factory private dining room. The Independence issue of 28 May 1921 was devoted to the Balfour Declaration. I'm quoting, "When the British army passed into Jerusalem in the memorable capture of the city in 1917, the protocols of the Elders of Zion went with it." The article then explains how dangerous Zionism is. "There are three elements of danger in the situation today. The overwhelmingly predominant Bolshevik element that is being poured into Palestine, so socialist Zionists. The intense, egotistic, and challenging nationalism that Zionists exhibit even before they get a potato patch. And third, the taste for world politics and world power. For Cameron, Zionism serves the interests of both Jewish capital and Jewish Bolshevism, which are linked in that the former fear the latter, and they want to be spared its wrath. The government of Palestine, he writes, is Jewish, headed by the Zionist Sir Herbert Samuel and Vladimir Jabotinsky, whom Cameron improbably calls a Bolshevik. Treated as a dignitary, even though he organized attacks against defenseless Arabs, whom the Jews are trying to drive out of the country. Now, Cameron displays sympathy for Palestinian Arabs, who are being purloined, and he claims that the Declaration's clause about protecting the civil and religious rights of natives was merely designed to appease Jewish non-Zionists. This is a very interesting variant of 20th century anti-Semitism. It acknowledges a divide between Zionist and non-Zionist Jews. It equates Zionism with Bolshevism, non-Zionism with capitalism. It posits a struggle between them, a struggle that the Zionist Bolsheviks are determined to win. This is evocative of the Red Scare in the United States in the immediate post-war period. Like so many anti-Semites, Cameron is afraid of the Jews. He implores Christian philo-Semites not to be mollified by the Jews' honeyed claims to be restoring their biblical homeland. Cameron asserts that the Jews who are invading Palestine are not the Israelites of old. His critique of Zionism dovetails perfectly with his British Israelism, an assertion of Anglo-Saxon racial authenticity and antiquity. If the Red Scare was a mass manifestation of fear, British Israelism was an expression of only slightly less charges, such as anxiety over the changing ethnic makeup of the United States and the loss of white hegemony, and resentment against the economic success of non-WASPs. In 1920, Cameron had reproduced comments from 1903 from Herzl and Nordau, in which both men had spoken of a world war, British ascendancy in the Middle East, and a future peace settlement in which Jews would obtain Palestine. Cameron implied from this that the Zionists planned the war. He appears to be unaware that lots of people in the early 20th century were talking about a coming world war and its consequences. Now, these outlandish claims were repeated in the final text I will analyze today, a critique of the Balfour Declaration, again, with this powerful ideological bric-a-brac, obviously with a deep emotional underpinning, but this very intricate kind of argument, written by a man named Robert John and published in the Journal of Historical Review in 1985 and 1986. Now, this is a journal you might know, which is not a scholarly journal. It's devoted to Holocaust denial and various forms of anti-Semitism. A surprising venue for Robert John, a British lawyer and the co-author with Sami Haddawi, who at one time was director of the Institute for Palestine Studies in Beirut, of a quite reputable book called The Palestine Diary, about British and American and UN involvement in interwar Palestine. The article is well written and littered with footnotes, but it takes at face value British, German, and French estimations of the power of the Jews to mobilize financial assistance and global Jewry. John claims that by 1916 the war was draining all sides and a negotiated peace would have been reached but for American entry into the war, which was instigated by the Jews for their benefit, including the attainment of Palestine. In fact, Wilson, he argues, decided to go to war months before the German declaration of unrestricted U-boat warfare and the notorious Zimmermann telegram, which revealed a German-Mexican plot to invade the southwestern United States. He relies on the memoirs of a rather dubious Armenian nationalist activist and British subject named James Malcolm that Wilson was pushed into the war by Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice, who had only obtained his seat on the court as a result of blackmail, for love letters written to his neighbor's wife while serving as president of Princeton University. So it's a long and complicated story, but the point is that Brandeis only got to the court through Jewish chicanery. Now, unlike Cameron, John does not posit a split between Bolshevik and capitalist Jews. He claims that American German Jewish bankers supported the Bolshevik Revolution by loaning funds to Russia. So it gets, you know, a bit wacky. He admits to a sharp clash between Zionists and a non-Zionist financial elite, between, say, Edward Montagu and English Zionists, and he admits to this sort of thing, and he blames the failure of initiatives for a separate peace with the Ottoman Empire entirely on Chaim Weizmann, relying on the memoirs of a former State Department official. Now, it is actually possible, by the way, that Weizmann did try to discredit all attempts at a separate peace with the Ottoman Empire because he indeed did want Palestine for the Jews. It's possible. But Weizmann should not be blamed for these intricate anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, first propounded by John. And by the way, I've not seen anywhere near as intricate a conspiracy theory about the Balfour Declaration in the European anti-Semitic press of the time. That's why I mentioned Cameron. We see, and I'm very sorry to say he was a graduate of the University of Toronto. We see in both writers baseless claims emanating from a fear and hatred of Jews. And the term Judeophobia, or Judenhass in German, is really a far more accurate term to describe these sentiments than the sanitized word antisemitism, coined in 1879 by the journalist Wilhelm Marr to lend ideological gravitas to animosity towards Jews. The account by Robert John of the alleged blackmail of President Wilson, it maintains the tradition of associating Jews with criminality and sexual depravity. And surely John did the Palestinian cause no good by raising it in a deeply flawed article in a journal that espouses Holocaust denial. Doing so makes it all too easy to link the all too real sufferings endured by Palestinians with the imaginary complaints of anti-Semites. Palestinians have endured at the hands of Israelis, the depredations and humiliations that anti-Semites claimed to have been the work of Jews, but in fact, Jews bore very little responsibility for it. It is not unsurprising, but it is disheartening that supporters of Palestinians can and do at times repeat anti-Semitic canards. What is more interesting, though, and as I move to the end, more relevant for my focus, is the extent to which oppressed peoples, including Palestinians, and anti-Semites share a common emotional vocabulary, consisting of feelings of fear, resentment, hatred, and anger. For oppressed peoples, shame and frustration carry a greater significance than in European anti-Semitic discourse, because these feelings arise when one deals with a bona fide act of victimization and is unable or unwilling to avenge it or seek redress. So anti-Zionism and anti-Semitic discourse are often compared, but I would argue at the end that Zionism and anti-Semitic discourse can also in a strange way be tied together as secret sharers. As I said at the outset, Zionism and anti-Semitism, varieties of nationalism and racism, share a swath of negative emotions. Like other forms of racism, however, anti-Semitism is virtually free of positive emotions. How many anti-Semites employ their arguments as expressions of love or pride or joy? All nationalisms can be cruel and exclusionary. Zionism is no exception. But they can be inspirational and inculcate into humanity a yearning for achievement and solidarity. Perhaps it is wrong for people to love their countries, but love them they often do. Whether the love is naive, as it was for Weizmann, or sentimental, as it was for Herzl, Zionism has constructed an affective matrix and a national home that has sustained millions of Jews, psychically as well as physically. Anti-Semitism, too, can provide people with a sense of emotional satisfaction in that it accounts for their personal or collective failures or limitations. But its therapeutic powers are feeble until and unless it is raised into a frenzy, and then usually with disastrous consequences. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Harvard University visiting professor of history, Derek Penslar. Professor Penslar's lecture was titled Zionism and Antisemitism, Ideologies or Emotions, and was presented by the Boston University Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies. Tonight's moderator was Wiesel Center Professor of Religion, Michael Zank. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lightodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.